In the long and exhausting battle against COVID-19, this was a big week for our area.
Because of the dramatic decline in our COVID numbers, effective Monday, March 7th, the statewide school mask mandate will be lifted. Additionally, we will lift the statewide mandate in all childcare settings.
New Jersey's Phil Murphy was the first of the tri-state governors to lift mask restrictions, rules that had become a lightning rod of pandemic debate.
I'm happy because, like, everyone's, like, in my school, like, most people are vaccinated in my grade and my age, and they separated us by grade, and most of my grade already had COVID.
This week on 880 In Depth, we sit down with New Jersey's health commissioner on where to next in the pandemic.
We have to look at what we know about viruses. We have to every day learn more about COVID-19, and we do learn something new every day. And we have to be prepared for surges and variants, but we also have to live our lives.
And as we hopefully begin to climb out of the pandemic, Judith Persichelli looks at how things could have been done differently.
The messaging overall, internationally, nationally, and even in our own state, has caused some confusion.
Welcome to 880 In Depth. I'm Steve Scott. Judith Persichelli famously signed on as New Jersey's health commissioner in the summer before COVID arrived. It has been her single focus for the past 2+ years. With New Jersey among the states feeling comfortable enough to lift the mask mandate, we sat down with the New Jersey health commissioner to hear, why now? Reporter Peter Haskell spoke to the commissioner this week.
Well, as we see our cases decrease and the disease progression seem to slow down pretty substantially, you know, we have to start asking ourselves the question, what is our new normal going to look like? And when we balance the risks of children continuing to go to school, with some of them really struggling with having masks on, not being able to see the facial expressions of not only their teachers, but of their peers, of their friends in class, versus the risk that we believe is present, particularly in New Jersey right now, we felt by the first week in March would be a really good time, if things continue to improve, to see how children do without masks in school, and to try to introduce the new normal, if I can use that term, introduce the new normal into their lives. And it's a risk-benefit equation, as with everything, as we've dealt with this virus. But we believe that the benefits of children starting to see some normalcy far outweigh the risk.
Frankly, that is an argument that's been made by folks opposed to mask mandates for months. So take us through this process over the period of time that it's taken to reach the point where we are now.
What we've been doing to reach the point
where we are now? Yes, exactly. How did you come to this decision?
Well, I like to say, and we kind of forget this, like as Mark Twain said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. As we look at what's happened in the past, and I would have to say that the pandemic, the influenza pandemic of 1918, is certainly some things that we can learn from that pandemic. And what we learned is that it was not just the pandemic of 1918. It didn't end in 1919. And in fact, a new variant emerged, in 1920, which became like the fourth wave. And what we learned from 1918 is that the population had to look at mitigation techniques, being outside. As you recall, they moved people outside with good ventilation, putting people outside, social distancing, and, you know, something we have now that they didn't have, vaccinations, but those basic public health layered prevention strategies worked in 1918. So you bring all of that forward now to 2022 and our great pandemic that is lasting as long. And we do expect we're going to see surges, and then we're going to see things calm down, and then we might see surges again. But what we have that we didn't have back in 1918 is, you know, three effective vaccines that will help to decrease severe disease, hospitalization, and death, and that will help us get to operationalizing all of our public health activities into our everyday lives and start continuing to our new normal. So we have to look at history. We have to look at what we know about viruses. We have to every day learn more about COVID-19, and we do learn something new every day. And we have to be prepared for surges and variants, but we also have to live our lives.
You've used the term new normal a few times already. How do you define that? What do you think the new normal looks like?
Well, I hope that the new normal incorporates everything we've learned about basic good public health. And one is taking better care of ourselves, making sure that we wash our hands frequently, staying home if we're sick, making sure we call our healthcare providers if we are sick enough that we need some follow-up, making sure that we cough and remember coughing into your arm, and maybe not as much shaking of hands as a courtesy when we see people and we greet and meet people. It's really thinking about public health and protecting yourself and others every single day. And hopefully part of that will be mask wearing if you're not feeling well.
Case counts have dropped dramatically over the past month. How long do you think it's going to be until the pandemic is over?
Well, I wish I could answer that question. I'd probably make a lot of money, right? Because everyone's asking that question. I think it's never going to be to zero. I think we will get to a point of endemicity where it becomes endemic and we live with COVID like we've learned to live with flu and its variants over time. I think we'll learn to live with it. And we'll learn to live with it well if we don't forget the lessons learned from the worst of this pandemic. And that's better public health strategies.
Some of this can be confusing for people, even with the best of intentions. For so long, we've heard about the importance of wearing a mask, and now we hear, it's your choice. So how should someone evaluate their risk and figure out how to make the best decisions for themselves?
That's a great question, and one of the things we talk about here at the Department of Health is how we encourage people to take accountability for themselves and their loved ones, and that it's more an issue of respect than anything else. When I wear a mask, for instance, I am saying I'm protecting you from me. Source control. I'm protecting you from me. I respect you enough that if I'm not feeling well, I'm going to put a mask on. Or if I feel that I've been exposed to someone not feeling well, I'm going to put a mask on because I respect you enough that I'm going to protect you from me. And that accountability is, I think, an accountability that we have to take for each other so we can live peacefully in civilization.
But there's a segment of the population that's really been following the mask guidelines very strictly. And so they hear what's happening now and they wonder, should I wear a mask when I go out? Do I need to wear a mask when I go out? How do I determine if and when to wear a mask?
I like to tell people to go to our website and look at what we call the CALI score. The CALI score is something that we've been publishing since the beginning of the pandemic, It's the Coronavirus Activity Level Index, and it breaks the state into six regions: Northeast, Northwest, Central East, Central West, Southeast, Southwest. And by color, it will show you how risky your region is. So if it's low risk, it's going to be green, so you can go out without a mask. If it's a moderate risk, it's going to be yellow. And you might, if you're not feeling well, you might say, well, like I said, out of respect for everyone around me, I'm going to wear a mask, because maybe you're not feeling well and there's moderate disease progression in your region. If it's orange, which means that people are showing up in our emergency rooms with what we call COVID-like illness at higher levels, that means that the positivity and the cases per 100,000 are higher than we would like, you might consider wearing a mask when you go to church, an indoor space where you're not sure of the people around you, their vaccination status, or whether they're feeling well or not, or that you're not sure of the ventilation because you're going indoors. So if you're in orange, you might say, I think it's time for me to wear a mask because I'm going to go to a concert tonight, and I don't know who all those people are. If I'm not feeling well and it's in an area of higher risk, I'm going to wear a mask. And then if it's red, I would say you would want to pay very close attention to mask wearing indoors and maybe outdoors, and particularly in crowded spaces.
I hate to say it, but it sounds confusing still.
I think that all that has happened with this virus over time and how it has changed and how we are dealing with surges and variants that almost seemingly come out of the blue, it is confusing. There is no doubt that the messaging has been confusing. And that's why we have to start internalizing layered prevention strategies into our everyday lives and start making decisions for ourselves when we don't feel well, when we're with individuals in, again, spaces where we're not sure about their vaccination. It's also a reason why we should get vaccinated and boosted, so that everybody has a high level of protection. But I cannot disagree with you. The messaging overall, internationally, nationally, and even in our own state, has caused some confusion.
And Persichelli admits the confusion in messaging has helped contribute to the great partisan divide we see in America today over public health.
From your perspective, how did we reach this point where partisanship has become so wrapped up in public health?
Well, it's sad to say that it's wrapped up in public health, as far as I'm concerned, because public health transcends a political party. It transcends race, ethnicity. It has nothing to do with anything other than every person deserves the best chance to be healthy and to live a long and safe life. That's our goal here at the department. So we try to stay away from that. How did it get to this point? I really can't answer that, because vaccines have been a way of life for every single one of us. There are about 20 vaccines that are required. There are vaccines that are required for you to be able to work in a hospital. You must get a flu vaccine every year. There's vaccines that are required up to age two, which is pretty frequent, so that you can live a long, healthy life. So we have vaccines as part of our life. For some of us, we remember lining up in school to get the polio vaccine. There was never a question about it, because polio was striking individuals and putting them, paralyzing them and putting them in iron lungs. So vaccines are a part of our life. Why it has become such a firestorm, I don't understand. I can just say that here at the department, we just want to make sure everyone has the information they need to make the best decisions for themselves.
You brought up variants earlier. We've seen that Omicron has waned. How concerned are you about a new variant?
I am concerned. I think that this virus has shown that it likes to mutate and change. Even though we are one of the most vaccinated states, we need to get our booster rates up to keep the immune protection up in all of our, as many residents as possible, because this virus seeks out unvaccinated individuals, enters the body, mutates, and turns around and affects other people. So a vaccination is certainly, and boosting is certainly a way to stop variants from occurring. I also know that we're on alert for variants. Our laboratories throughout the state and again nationally and internationally know what to look for in sequencing specimens so that they're picking up on variants much more quickly than we did in the very beginning. You may recall there were no tests to detect SARS-CoV-2 when this pandemic broke out in the United States. In fact, we were not approved here in our own public health lab to perform the sequencing tests, PCR tests, till March 17th of 2020. And we had our first case on March 4th of 2020. But we have moved past all of that. We can test for the variants. We can see them coming. We can prepare. We have a great degree of collaboration between our local public health departments and offices, emergency, Office of Emergency Medicine, the state police, the Department of Health, all of our healthcare providers. We can be prepared in 24 hours to meet and prevent the spread of disease of any variant that comes up.
With the benefit of hindsight, what do you think the state could have done better?
That's a really good question and an interesting question, and certainly something that's a question we have on our list for when we can actually take time to take more deep breaths and do a really deep dive into how we responded early on. I keep trying to remind everyone here, as we at times get a little discouraged and weary, that when we had our first case, March 4th of 2020, there was so much we did not know about this virus. For example, we did not know about asymptomatic spread. In most cases, a virus is most contagious when you're showing symptoms. We did not know that 2 to 3 days before you show symptoms, you could be as contagious. We did not know exactly what this virus was and how it got into humans. It was a novel virus, never before seen in humans. So we were responding pretty aggressively to the symptoms we were seeing, the number of people we were see get sick, the number of people being admitted to our hospitals, the number of people in intensive care, and those that unfortunately had to have ventilators and terribly died from COVID. And we didn't have any vaccines. So what could we have done better? I believe that at this point in time, we really have to go deep into our understanding, our prior understanding of viruses and what works best to keep them under control, generally and specifically for COVID. We put in all of the mitigation activities that had worked in the past, and this virus kept on eluding the immunity that was built up over time in individuals, and unfortunately became the third largest reason for death in New Jersey.
Should there have been better decisions made in regards to nursing homes?
Better decisions for what, Peter?
In regards to nursing homes.
Nursing homes, obviously, it's one of the areas we're going to put under a really strict microscope. As you know, nursing homes got hit hard. They got hit very quickly. After New York got hit, we got hit. Nursing homes, the resiliency, I think, was not as strong as we had thought. We had given them pretty strict guidelines in how to protect their residents. And what we didn't realize is the virus was coming into nursing homes by asymptomatic spread, healthcare workers and visitors. And by the time that caught up with us, it was a devastating impact on our nursing homes. So now we know that we need to be more vigilant when there's high disease progression, because we know the first place this virus will go will be our nursing homes and our vulnerable elderly.
What is it about this job that currently keeps you up at night?
Well, what keeps me up at night is the challenge we have in maintaining our high level of vigilance every single day. So in addition to all of the other things that the Department of Health does, making sure that children that have elevated lead levels are taken care of, and that we work with lead screenings, that we continue our work with maternal morbidity and mortality to try to make New Jersey one of the safest places to have your baby, that we continue to focus on substance use disorder and stem deaths from overdoses. All of those items that we have to continue looking at and working with, in addition now to being hypervigilant about this virus of SARS-CoV-2 and its variants. So what keeps me up at night is to make sure that we have a strong public health local infrastructure so that outbreaks can be recognized immediately, and that we work here at the department with the local public health officials to control spread, so that we never again see the devastating effects of SARS-CoV-2.
The weight of the pandemic can certainly be seen in the healthcare industry across America today. Doctors, nurses, nurses' aides, all leaving the profession in numbers that are concerning. We wanted to hear what the veteran healthcare administrator, Judy Persichelli, thought about that.
What's the state of the healthcare industry right now?
Well, you know, I worked for a very long time on the front lines. And when I think of what they went through, whether it was an aide in a nursing home or a critical care nurse and critical care intensivist doctor in a busy, busy ICU, when I think of what they went through during that first surge, the first thing I say to them is that we owe them a debt of gratitude for the work that they've done. And we should never forget that. We should never forget that they were fighting probably the worst battle we have ever fought, certainly on our land. And as we honor veterans of our past wars, we should honor them repeatedly for the work that they've done. And we should help them. We should support them. We should make sure that they have the mental health services that they need to deal with the PTSD that they have for being on the front lines. And that's number one. Number two, you need to give them the information and the education they need to protect themselves because they are too valuable to us to fall ill, and unfortunately for some of them to die from this virus. And that's helping them understand what's in the vaccines, why they're safe and effective, how important boosters are, because we cannot afford to have our healthcare frontline workers fall ill repeatedly from SARS-CoV-2. So COVID-19 has really taken a big toll on our healthcare workers. And I can only say that from my perspective, they deserve all the support we can give them, but also all the education and information they need to make wise decisions about themselves in terms of their own health.
Commissioner, last question for you. You came out of retirement for this job. Do you have any plans to step away?
Well, eventually. I'm sorry, I'm not laughing at the question. You know, it's I'm not a what they would call a spring chicken. I felt that I took this job as commissioner because I've spent my whole life in healthcare. It seems I've spent my whole life, majority of my life in healthcare, and I thought it would be a great way to give back to the state that I love, that I've lived in my whole life, communities that I have worked in, to you know, help them in a different way, in a way that brings, again, our mission to life for everyone in New Jersey to have to reach their highest potential and have long, healthy lives. Did I expect that a pandemic would hit us? Of course not. No, did I expect that I'd be working, you know, 7 days a week, almost 24/7 for 2.5 years? Of course not. Do I expect that we will hit this new normal and we will go back to very active and good lives, myself included? Yes. And when that occurs, it might be time for me to give this seat up to someone who will have the energy to carry that new normal forward.
Do you have any idea how long it'll be till you get to that point?
I don't have any indication how long it'll get to that point. I just know that we will.
Commissioner, thank you so much for your time, as always, and your patience. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Peter. It's always enjoyable to talk with you.
In Depth is a production of WCBS News Radio 880. Peter Haskell and Tim Scheld are the executive producers. Subscribe to the podcast so you won't miss a week. Just look for 880 In Depth wherever you get your audio. I'm Steve Scott. Thank you for listening.